My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Milwaukee, residents of Sherman Park are helping their area become greener and shadier as members of Wisconsin's first community tree board.
We are sort of the tree ambassadors, I say, for the neighborhoods.
Felice Green is a member of the volunteer board, and she works at the nonprofit Milwaukee Water Commons, which helped establish it. She says as the climate changes, trees help protect communities by providing cooling shade and absorbing stormwater. But Sherman Park and other historically underserved communities have fewer trees than other areas. So planting more is important, and she says residents need a voice in that process.
We recognize the importance of everybody has an opinion, everybody has a say.
So the tree board talks to people about their priorities and concerns. For example, they invite residents to help choose which species get planted. They answer questions about how to manage fallen leaves. And before planting on a vacant lot, they ask nearby homeowners for permission. These conversations take time, but Green says they're worth it to get people on board and excited about growing and caring for trees in their community.
We want people to have a strong love relationship with trees.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions. You're listening to A New Dimensions Archive Edition, recorded in 2012. For the past three decades, British biologist Rupert Sheldrake has been asking questions that most scientists either haven't thought of asking or are discouraged from asking by the unwritten codes that often prevail in our scientific and academic institutions. Educated at Cambridge and Harvard, Dr. Sheldrake is the author of more than 80 scientific papers and 10 books, including his groundbreaking A New Science of Life, The Rebirth of Nature, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, and his best-selling investigation into animal telepathy, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. Dr. Sheldrake is perhaps best known for his morphic field theory, which takes a fresh look at memory, habit, instinct, and heredity, as well as phenomena such as telepathy, which are unexplained in terms of current physics. This edition of New Dimensions features a talk given by Dr. Sheldrake in late 2012 to announce the American release of his new book, Science Set Free. In this presentation, sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, Sheldrake turns some of the constricting dogmas and assumptions of modern science into open questions that can themselves be tested scientifically rather than being accepted on faith alone. Join us for the next hour as we hear Dr. Rupert Sheldrake introduce Science Set Free. My name is Dan Drayson. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions.
Well, thank you so much. This book, Science Set Free, is called The Science Delusion in England. And what science is being set free from, I hope, is the science delusion. The science delusion is the belief that science already understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. That, I think, is a profoundly mistaken view, and that there's a conflict within science which is actually constricting science from what it should be doing. I see science as a means of exploring reality. But there's another side of science, which is science as a worldview or a dogmatic belief system. Now, most people are incredulous when I suggest that science is a dogmatic belief system, because they say, well, surely science is the one thing that enables us to go beyond dogmatic beliefs. It's the one thing that pays full attention to evidence and free inquiry and open-minded thinking. That's an ideal of science, and it's an ideal that I share, but it's not one that's usually put into practice. Within the sciences, there's a very strongly defined set of beliefs, which most scientists don't even realize are beliefs. They think other people have beliefs, Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, and so on, but they don't have beliefs, they know the truth. And these beliefs are taken to be such established truths that they're not even discussed. And most people outside the scientific world assume they must be true because science is so successful and has such huge prestige as a result of it. What I do in this book, Science Set Free, is take the 10 most important dogmas of modern science and I turn them into questions, treating them as hypotheses that can be tested rather than assumptions you can't challenge. The 10 dogmas are as follows. First, the belief that the whole world is mechanical or machine-like. The universe is a machine, animals are machines, plants are machines, humans are machines, lumbering robots, in Richard Dawkins' evocative phrase. Now, that's the first and the most central assumption. But it's not a proof to many places of decimals tested by experiment. It's just a metaphor. You can't prove a metaphor. It's useful in certain respects, but not in others. And my view is that nature is much better thought of as organic, as the universe is like a developing organism. Well, that's the first assumption or dogma. The second is that matter is unconscious. The universe is made up of atoms, molecules, stars, galaxies, crystals, all of which are completely unconscious. Everything in nature is unconscious, except human brains and maybe the brains of a number of other higher animals, or for the liberal materialists, maybe going down as far as insects or worms. But nevertheless, matter itself is intrinsically unconscious. Then there's the assumption that the laws of nature are fixed. The laws of nature are the same today as they were at the moment of the Big Bang, and they'll be the same forever. And as well as the laws being fixed, the constants are fixed. The gravitational constant, the speed of light, and so on, have always been the same. The next assumption is that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same, the principle of conservation of matter and energy. Next, that nature is purposeless, and the entire evolutionary process has no purpose or direction. Next, biological inheritance is material. Everything that organisms inherit is inherited materially, mainly as DNA, or now there's added complexity through epigenetic modifications of the DNA, or through cytoplasmic inheritance. But essentially, most people treat the word hereditary as if it's synonymous with genetic. Assumption number 7 is that memories are stored as material traces inside the brain. Dogma 8, the mind is inside the head. Mental activity is brain activity. It's all inside your head. Dogma 9 follows from number 8, psychic phenomena are illusory. Things like telepathy may appear to exist. Lots of people may believe they've had telepathic experiences, but that's because they're not smart enough to realize it's just coincidence or must have some other perfectly normal explanation. It's an illusion. And dogma 10, mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. Alternative and complementary therapies may appear to work, but that's because people would have got better anyway, or it's just the placebo effect. Well, those are the 10 beliefs which underlie the modern worldview. Within science, some of them are questioned by some scientists in some areas of science, and as I hope to show, all of them really have been superseded by advances in science itself. But nevertheless, these are the beliefs that most people pick up during the course of their scientific education, or indeed in the course of any kind of education, because almost all modern people have been brought up to have a respect for science and to believe it must be true. So these are the default assumptions of most educated people. Now, when we turn them into questions, things look very different. First of all, within science, you're not meant to question them. If you question them, you break taboos. And there's all sorts of sanctions against breaking taboos. I don't have time this evening to go into all 10 delusions, but I'll just deal with two or three of them. I'll start with the total amount of matter and energy is always the same, since the moment of the Big Bang, when all the matter and energy in the universe suddenly appeared. As my friend Terence McKenna used to say, modern science is based on the principle, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nothing in a single instant. As Terence used to say, that's the limit case of credulity. If you can swallow that, you can swallow anything. This is the assumption that I myself questioned last. I only really questioned it 2 or 3 years ago. I'd questioned all the others during the course of my scientific career, but not that one. I thought this is the one that's most certain, that's most unquestionable, and it's the one that I believed longest because I learned it in elementary physics lessons. I thought, though, I should include it in this book because I also thought it would be good to find at least one of the dogmas of science was true. I didn't want to seem one-sided by finding all 10 were false. I hoped that this one would turn out to be true. I had nothing against it to start with. But the more I looked into it, the more dodgy it seemed, until I now see it as a house of cards built on foundations of sand, to combine metaphors. First of all, what's the history? Is this something people have established by detailed experiments measuring things with incredible accuracy to many places of decimals? No. This dogma is based on philosophical and theological assumptions that have been around for centuries, even millennia. They were codified in the 19th century, in the 1850s, in fact, in the laws of thermodynamics and in the principle of conservation of matter and energy, and appear to be certain truths. But while most of us may pay a great deal of reverence to these principles, physicists themselves have felt less bound by them. In the 1980s, it became clear that galaxies were attracting each other much more than they ought to. If you add up all the matter in the stars, make a generous allowance for black holes and planets and gas clouds, it also turned out that stars within galaxies were being attracted much more than they should have been, according to the amount of matter in the galaxies. So something was wrong with this model. So how could physicists fix it? Well, simple. They could increase the amount of gravity by just adding in more matter to their equations. You add in exactly the right amount to make the equations balance. And what is this matter they've added in? Well, it's dark matter. We don't know what it is, but we know it must be there because it makes the equations balance. To this day, nobody knows what dark matter is. Its nature is literally obscure. And there's 5 times more of it than there is of regular matter. Now, is dark matter conserved? Is the total amount always the same? Can it be converted to regular matter? So could regular matter just appear from nowhere or disappear into dark matter? Nobody knows, because nobody knows what dark matter is, how it works, or what it does. But this caused a new problem, because suddenly there's all this extra matter in the universe, which meant the whole universe was more massive than anyone had previously supposed. And now what about the expansion of the universe? The universe is expanding, but it's also being pulled back by gravitation, the gravitation of everything within the universe. So now there's a lot more matter in the universe. It ought to be causing the universe to slow down in its expansion and finally stop expanding and then begin to contract. In the 1990s, that's what most cosmologists thought, that the universe was going to slow down, then contract, until it all ended in tears, in the reverse of the Big Bang, known in the trade as the Big Crunch. Everything would finally implode into a black hole. But around 1998, it turned out that, from observation of distant galaxies, that far from slowing down, the expansion of the universe was speeding up. Things were expanding faster and faster. Now, how could you explain that? Simple. There must be a new kind of energy in the universe that's pushing everything apart. Dark energy. And just add in the right amount that you need to make the equations balance and fit the observations, and you've fixed the problem. But it causes yet another problem for physics, because it turns out the amount of dark energy is increasing. As the universe expands, you get more dark energy. The universe is now a perpetual motion machine. Roughly speaking, today, the current estimate is that just over 96% of the universe consists of dark matter and dark energy. Less than 4% consists of the kind of matter and energy you learned about at school and to which these laws of conservation of matter and energy are supposed to apply. What if dark energy can be converted into regular energy? What if regular energy can be converted into dark energy? Is that possible? Nobody knows. This room is full of dark matter and dark energy. We've no idea how they might be interacting with processes going on in our physical world. Meanwhile, in quantum theory, an essential part of it is the idea that the world is filled with another kind of energy, the zero-point energy or quantum vacuum field energy. The quantum vacuum is not a vacuum, it's a plenum. It's full of energy. But what if we could tap it? Could we tap any of these mysterious forms of energy in the universe? Well, the usual assumption is, of course not, because the conservation of matter and energy forbids all these kinds of perpetual motion machine ideas. But the world is full of inventors working in garages and sheds who claim to have above-unity devices, free energy devices. Go on the online and search for above-unity devices and you'll find a vast array of claims out there. I've seen one of them in England. A friend of mine is in a company that has developed one of these devices. It does indeed seem to give out twice as much energy as you put in. It's been tested in a couple of universities who've written reports, couldn't find anything wrong with it, but didn't want their reports to be published because it would discredit their university and their physics department, because this is such a taboo area. So do any of these devices work? If they did, they could provide boundless amounts of energy that would completely transform the world economy and ecology and change the way we think about the future. Do they work or don't they? Because they defy this dogma, they're kept in the fringe areas of science. They're in a realm of parascience or fringe science. What could we do about it? If we take the view that perhaps some of these forms of energy really exist and can be tapped, how would you find out? Well, my suggestion is a competition, $1 million prize. People could submit their various claims, their devices, have them tested by engineers and physicists who would not be trying to debunk them, but give an honest appraisal of whether this is working as it seems to. Some have already been tested and do seem to work as they're claimed to. If anyone wins this prize, I think it would change the climate, because people would then invest in these things and things would happen. Right now, they have small investors, but as soon as they go to the big investors, like the big energy companies, they then call up their physics advisors, and, you know, within 5 minutes, the guy will say, you know, these people are claiming it's above unity. That's impossible. This is just another perpetual motion machine crank. Forget it. The prejudice is so great that it's very hard for them to get investment. If anyone won this prize, I think the climate would completely change. And if nobody won it, because if none of them really work, the conventional people would have the sweet delight of saying, I told you so. It turns out that the principle of conservation of matter and energy when applied to living organisms is equally dodgy. And this was one of the most shocking discoveries for me. I'm a biologist, and I'd always taken for granted that living organisms follow the law of conservation of matter and energy. When I looked into the history, I found that it wasn't at all clear what was going on. In the early 19th century, particularly in Germany, many biologists thought that living organisms had another kind of energy over and above the regular kind. They called it vital energy or life force. In the 1850s, Hermann von Helmholtz, better known as a physicist, made it his mission to prove that living organisms were nothing but machines. He tried to prove it by doing experiments with frogs' legs, making them twitch by electrical stimulation and measuring the heat given out to try and show they followed normal laws of heat and work. He couldn't get any accurate results, so he gave up an empirical test and stuck to a theoretical argument. Living organisms are machines, therefore they obey the normal laws of physics and chemistry and conservation of matter and energy, therefore living organisms are machines. It was a circular argument. He assumed what he set out to prove, and after that, it was taken as a certain fact in biology. It wasn't until 1899 that anyone tried to test this experimentally with human beings, and there was one test with a dog before that. In the United States, Atwater and Benedict, who were two of the founders of nutrition science in America, had people in calorimeters, insulated boxes. They'd live in them for several weeks. All the gases going in and out were measured, the urine, the feces, the food, the energy, and so on. And they did this to establish, or as they put it, demonstrate, that humans were nothing but machines obeying the regular laws of physics. Their first results turned out to be wrong, so they simply changed the correction values for the nutritive values of the foods so they could get the right answer. And they came up with a result in agreement with the theory to an accuracy of 99.9%. Everyone heaved a sigh of relief. This was now proved. It was the foundation of nutrition science. It was a firm foundation for biology. People wrote articles saying it was the last nail in the coffin of vitalism and so forth. It wasn't until the 1970s that this work was re-examined by an American nutritionist called Paul Webb, working in the Midwest. He redid their experiments and found huge discrepancies. He found that people who were obese and doing very little exercise put out about 25% less energy than they ought to have done, whereas people who were not eating and doing a lot of exercise somehow had excess to 25% more energy than they should have done. He then looked back at the classical results of Atwater and Benedict. They'd found similar discrepancies, but they'd carefully got the right number of people below the average and the right number above the average, so they cancelled out to give this perfect expected result. When Webb published his results showing these massive discrepancies, instead of it causing consternation in the world of nutrition science, it was just ignored. When people in other cultures, like Hindus, talk of prana, or Chinese or Japanese talk of qi or ki energy, this is treated as purely metaphorical. It can't be real, because we know that living organisms obey the normal laws of ordinary energy. But nutrition science is full of anomalies. All over the world, in India, in medieval Europe, in China, in the United States, there are people who claim to be able to live without food. These breatharians, as they're now called, have a long ancestry in many parts of the world. Some have been tested and found to be fraudulent. Some have been tested by scientists over the centuries, including quite recently in India, and found to be mysteriously able to live in apparent defiance of the normal laws of energy. Now, the normal assumption is these people are complete frauds. Anyone who investigates them must be a flaky scientist. Any results that don't debunk these people must be fraudulent or flawed, and the issue's closed. But what if it isn't closed? If I were a nutrition scientist, this would seem to me one of the most interesting questions that we could possibly ask. Is there some other form of energy? The one certain finding in nutrition science in the last 20 years is the important effects of caloric restriction. Organisms that are fed half the normal calories, generally speaking, live much longer than those who get the normal diet. And this applies to people, mice, yeast. All sorts of organisms seem to follow this principle. Something may be going on with drawing in forms of energy, maybe from the quantum vacuum field, that mean that the standard assumptions of nutrition science are simply false. It also has a bearing on medicine, because many medical systems from other cultures are based on forms of energy ours isn't. Well, that's one set of assumptions. The total amount of matter and energy is always the same, the dogmatic assumption. When you look at it, as you see in both in physics and biology, the picture that emerges is not one of total certainty and 100% success. It's one of dogmatic beliefs and extraordinary anomalies, including 96% of the universe not being regular matter and energy, and discrepant experimental results. Now, if we look at some of these other assumptions, we find similar anomalies. Take the idea that the laws and constants of nature are fixed. Now, this is something I've been challenging for a long time. The idea of morphic resonance, which gives a kind of memory in nature, suggests that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. And I'm not going to speak about that now, because I'm not here particularly to push my own theories, but to open up the much bigger question in science. So instead of looking at the laws of nature, I'll look at the constants. Now, are the constants fixed? Is the gravitational constant or the speed of light, for example, completely fixed? Well, you might assume they must be. Surely this is something that's well known. But if you look at the data, a very different picture emerges. I started by going back through handbooks of physics, and in doing this I discovered that the speed of light dropped by 20 kilometers per second between 1928 and 1945 all over the world, and then it went up again to somewhere near its pre-1928 value. And the values that people found in labs all around the world were very accurate ones according to their own data. They had very small error bars. They were up there with the tiny error bars, then they went down here with tiny error bars, then they went up there. It wasn't as if there was a huge spread of error that encompassed this 20 kilometers per second drop. No, something else seemed to be happening. I went to talk about this to the head of the metrology section. Metrology is the science which measures the constants at the British National Physical Laboratory, Dr. Brian Petley. And so I said to him, now what do you make of this drop in the speed of light between 1928 and 1945? And then it went up again. He said, oh dear, he said, you've uncovered one of the most embarrassing episodes in the history of our science. And I said, well, it needn't be embarrassing. I said, what if the speed of light really dropped? Wouldn't that tell us something really exciting and interesting about the universe? He said, well, it couldn't have really dropped. And I said, why not? He said, because it's a constant. So then I said, well, then how do you explain this discrepancy, this drop, with people getting these small errors? I said, the only thing I can think of is that people, suddenly the fashion changed and people started adjusting their results, fudging them to get what they thought was the expected value. He said, oh, we don't like to use the word fudging. And I said, well, what word do you prefer? And he said, we prefer to call it intellectual phase locking. So I said, you mean that all around the world people intellectually phase locked on this new value, discarded discrepant values, corrected them till they got that right value, and then published values that agreed with what they thought everyone else was getting? He said, well, more or less. And I said, well, then when it went up again, then the same thing happened. He said, yes, more or less. I said, well, could it happen again? He said, no, thank goodness it can't happen anymore. And I said, why not? He said, we fixed the speed of light by definition in 1972. And I said, you mean you've just defined it by a kind of fiat? And he said, yes. And I said, but what if it really changes? He said, we'd never know. So that's the state of play in the most fundamental of all constants in modern physics.
We're listening to Dr. Rupert Sheldrake introducing his book, Science Set Free. If you'd like more information about Dr. Sheldrake, his work, and his books, you can find it at www.sheldrake.org. That's sheldrake.org. Or you can get there via the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Dan Drazen, and you're listening to New Dimensions. Once again, here's Dr. Rupert Sheldrake introducing his book, Science Set Free. At a talk in San Francisco in late 2012, sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies.
With the most ancient of constants in physics, Newton's universe.